I cannot believe that there was a moment when people were like, this woman with an E-cup is walking to work and it might tank the entire economy, not just of the United States, but maybe of the world.
Ugh.
And that we don't teach that in high schools. Like, that wasn't on the AP exam.
I know.
Back on the show today, we have America's favorite professional talker, podcaster Sarah Marshall of You're Wrong About and You Are Good. For this episode, I'm telling Sarah about how, in 1968, one unsuspecting young woman's bust line almost caused a stock market bust when thousands of wolves of Wall Street came to wolf whistle at her on their white-collar lunch breaks. I also give some background on this riotous event by explaining an absurd 20-year craze called girl watching that taught genteel men the refined art of covertly checking out women. I'll also talk about the aftermath of that strange week in the financial district of New York City, both the avant-garde artist and feminist responses to the treatment of the woman who would come to be known as the Wall Street Sweater Girl. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and this is American Hysteria. Welcome, Sarah Marshall, our esteemed guest, as always, one of my most favorite people that inhabit this dark planet.
Aww.
I'm so happy you're here.
Ah, I'm so happy to be here.
Sarah, I'm going to tell you today a pretty wild story that I am very surprised that I didn't know, but hasn't gotten like a ton of attention, which is, of course, our favorite stories in the world. So are you buckled up? Are your arms and legs inside the ride at all times?
Yeah, I am holding a pillow to squeeze if I get scared. I have a hot cup of tea.
Oh,
I'm all ready.
Okay.
I'm as ready as I'm going to get.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Okay, so we're eventually going to get to the meat of this story, but of course we need background, we need context, but to give you a little taste of our big story today, it's about a woman who wore a tight yellow sweater and red skirt in 1968 and almost caused a riot on Wall Street.
Ronaldette McDonald.
A real ketchup and mustard kind of gal.
Jamie Loftus.
Yeah, it's just Jamie Loftus. Okay, so before we get to 1968, I want to talk to you about a phenomenon that was called girl watching. Have you ever heard of girl watching?
My dad was born in 1943. And, you know, you can have a dad who was born in the 90s who's a giant misogynist. But I feel like I was steeped in a very kind of like mid-century grossness in that way. And just the idea of kind of like girl watching as a normal, healthy spectator sport, I feel like just feels part of the idea of what men are like that I grew up with from my dad. But I'm also thinking when you say that of the Andy Williams song that goes like, the girls watch the boys, watch the girls watch the boys, and the girls go by. They put that in a lot of like cable TV promos in 2003 or something.
Which is like, I feel like your area of expertise.
Yes. If it happened on cable in like 1997 to 2003, I saw it. I was there. I absorbed it. I made a worldview out of it. I'm unpacking it to this day. But am I close to the relevant area?
I think you're close to the relevant area, but I think it may be more formal than you're expecting.
Great. Oh, no.
Okay. All right. So
the girls must be surveilled.
Of course. Of course. But before we get to this girl watching craze, which really was a 50s phenomenon, we're going to go back to a time before the post-war era, late 1800s, early 1900s, when actually the law and culture were a little bit more on the side of the woman in this like one way.
But just the one. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here.
No. Men's rights activists, calm down. Okay. So basically, in this time period, it was considered not just in poor taste, but like actually offensive to like leer at women and to catcall women on the street. Like that was actually something that was considered at one point possibly a crime. Mm-hmm. And so basically elite white women, obviously, were the yeah. ones who kind of had the ability to complain.
And when the law says women historically, that's kind of who it means.
Yeah. It's a given.
Like women affiliated with men who vote.
Exactly. Yes. Property owning men.
Right.
And their little wives.
Uh-huh. And their big wigs.
Have you ever heard of the term masher?
Yes. I was just thinking of that because there is this episode of Laverne and Shirley where everyone is worried about the Milwaukee masher.
And what does the Milwaukee masher do?
Well, in this case, he's like a vaguely defined sex pest slash criminal. Like it was always a little bit troublingly unclear where you were in that spectrum in 70s sitcoms. Sure. But he's, I think, just a man who's groping women on the street. I don't know if it's bigger than that.
I mean, it was a very popular term to describe basically sex pests. Yeah. Which is a word that I feel like is really underutilized in our culture because it really speaks to a particular type of person that maybe falls into a category that's a little bit different.
I feel like British people say sex pest and it's like it feels like we a borrowed term from them. And like culturally, what if we could take all of our worst British and American traits and I don't know, just throw them in the furnace.
Mash them together.
Mash them together and then mash together all our great stuff so we can have mash, obviously.
That's where all of this is leading culturally.
Yeah.
So the masher archetype kind of came about from fanboys of, you know, hot actresses of the time. So they would wait, you know, outside the theater usually, and they would basically try to get dates with these women really aggressively. And they were also called stage door Johnnies, which I think is a great name.
I've heard that term. Where have I heard that? I'm sure like All About Eve or a Nancy Reagan biography.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It was definitely in a Nancy Reagan.
And so, and this is like, when is this? Like late 19th century?
Late 19th century.
And so this is a time when acting is like not a very reputable career for women, too.
Yes. Yeah. Right. It's still theater acting. We haven't gotten into the move-in pictures yet. So generally, like it just was disapproved of, and it was even sort of encouraged, at least quietly, for women to fight back against these men who weren't just these stage door Johnnies. They were like, you know, following women home and right. calling them sweetie and cutie and as one article said, giving them goo-goo eyes and, you know, wow. wolf whistling and generally ogling them.
I feel like we're like plunging a narrow blade, a hat pin, if you will, deep into the fillet of like something that feels very at the heart of American culture, which is like, have you seen this is like a TikTok trend, I think, lately, like grandma was a victim, where it's like your grandma telling you like how she and your grandpa met. And she's like, oh, I was walking home to my parents' house and he started following me and he just wouldn't leave me alone. And after 3 weeks, I let him drive me over state lines so we could get married, or, you know, something less dramatic yes. than that. But like
something that doesn't violate the Mann Act quite yeah. so frequently.
Right. Sometimes, you know, you just stay inside the state because it's like, right, because it's very normalized, this idea that, you know, as any woman, but especially girls, that you're kind of a flower to be picked.
Yeah. I mean, that what you said makes me think of how bad The Notebook is as a movie, where she's like, no, I won't date you. And then he's like, well, I'll climb on this ride.
I've never liked that part. I know we love Ryan Gosling. We love The Notebook. We grew up with it. It doesn't, you gotta love what you love.
It's not Ryan's fault.
It's not his fault. He is Knuff, but like, right. And it's just like, just don't
threaten suicide on a Ferris wheel until a woman dates
just
you.
Just don't. And just, you know, and then this gets into like contemporary pickup artist culture, where it's like, you know, it becomes about the idea of playing this game. And that's, you know, there's some element of feudalism to all heterosexual dating culture, I think. Mm-hmm. But this is where it gets really weird.
Well, and it's also, you know, it's this thing that we still experience and understand much better now, that this mashing was, yes, like an attempt to get dates or to flirt with women and hopefully have something happen, have some kind of encounter. But it was also because at this time we have first wave feminism starting. We have women unaccompanied out in public who are not sex workers, which is, you know, one of the first times, or I guess probably the first time, that this has happened. And so, you know, there's a quality to this of punishment and of, you know, attempting to push women back into the private sphere.
Well, that makes me think about how, you know, the first kind of detective stories and the idea of the dead girl archetype that we now know so well through Laura Palmer et al., like, really begins with, like, I think the Marie Roget story, and kind of, I think, late 19th century literature, and is based to some extent on a real case that happened in, I want to say, Gilded Age New York. I'm playing fast and loose with timelines here, but that Sherlock Holmes appears in 1888. So does Jack the Ripper. You know, you and I have spent some time in this period talking about the Cottingley fairies and so forth. But mm-hmm. that, like, in this time of modernization and the Industrial Revolution, and yeah, like, women showing up unaccompanied in public, not as sex workers, and therefore there being this great cultural need to scare them back inside. The idea being that if you're, you know, out in the world, then you're asking for anything sexual violence wise.
Yeah, you're like fair game, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That there's, you know, it's open season on you, to quote Loretta Lynn. and isn't it interesting that kind of the dead girl archetype detective story, at least according to me personally, kind of appears at this moment too?
Yeah.
It's like, don't go out there. Stay in the house. Stay where only your husband will beat you.
Yeah.
Someone scarier could beat you more, or whatever.
Yeah. Better the devil you know, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the moral of most of these stories. Yeah.
Which kind of act like folklore now, in a way.
Yeah. And not that fun Taylor Swift kind either.
No. It's like folklore being created in the moment in order to create a boogeyman that is necessary to get what you want.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because, like, on the one hand, there's so many different types of crime that you kind of have in a big country enough data to kind of make whatever point you want. And yet, you know, I think this happened in London during a lockdown. A woman was walking home and a man impersonating a police officer abducted her and murdered her.
Yeah.
And when that kind of thing happens, I don't feel like it's just randomness. And I feel like, no, this is real. This is a trend. And, you know, and there are real trends within the data, but also that, you know, if you have vast numbers of crime to sort of massage trends out of, like we do today, you could ignore the very real trends that you don't have to do much work to see,
yeah.
Like trends around sexual violence and who commits it. And you can, you know, create more of an idea of what kind of norms are we trying to enforce and what kind of changes are we trying to stop from happening?
Absolutely. And at this time, shockingly, there were, you know, attempts to protect these women who were being ogled and given goo goo eyes and wolf whistle mm-hmm. that. And part of that was through self-defense, as I mentioned, and you actually already mentioned hat pins, which became like the de facto piece of self-defense equipment for these women at the turn of the century. And if one of these mashers came up to them, they would just stab them with their hat pins.
I really think we should encourage more stabbing of that nature.
You know? Well, here's a wonderful example of how the law at the time was at least somewhat on these women's side. This is a very extreme example that I just came across and thought you would like. Mm-hmm. This is from December of 1898 and involves a strong woman from a sideshow named Mademoiselle Susanetta. Yeah, right. And so her shtick was juggling cannonballs and breaking iron chains with her hands.
Good God. Amazing.
She had this stalker, this masher who would follow her around to shows. And at one point, she punched him so hard in the face that he actually was knocked out onto the ground.
Nice.
And he then tried to get her charged with assault and testified in front of the court and everything. And this strong woman let the judge know that, like, this dumb bitch has been annoying me for 2 entire days before she clocked him.
I thought you were going to say years. That's how bleak the outlook is for women now.
I know, right?
I think we have to put up with more. Gone are the days of being a carefree, strong woman.
Yeah. So basically, yes, this masher has been annoying her for 2 days before she clocked him. And once she explained that to the judge, he actually said, quote, "You are the woman this town has been looking for a long time." And then he dismissed all the charges, which is lovely.
My God.
I know.
And then he gives her the key to the city. And then everyone goes, ha, 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 ho, 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 and a couple of tra-la-las.
Yeah.
Yes, that's how we clock an old sex pest in the merry old land of Oz.
Oh, I can always count on you, Sarah.
Which of the Wizard of Oz characters do you most identify with?
Oh, I guess the Cowardly Lion. You know, just scared of everything, but also a lot. I don't know. I'm not sure. What about you?
I think of you as so brave. But we all see ourselves, you know, as I always say, Barbara Streisand describes herself as a director who sings, which is fucking unhinged.
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, I love the Scarecrow the most. I don't know if I identify with him, although I do. I see it. And the Tin Man as well. I think the Tin Man, here's what I think. I think the Scarecrow is trans and the Tin Man is autistic. And will I elaborate? No. Read the book. You'll see it.
Wow. What about the Lion?
Gay.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, that was clear from day one.
Right.
For sure.
That one was not hard. Yeah. But there's a thing in the book where the Tin Man steps on an ant or something and he starts crying and talking about how, as a heartless person, he has to be especially careful not to step on ants. And it's like, I don't know, I feel like L. Frank Baum, not a good person, inadvertently wrote this like very queer, very neurodivergent kind of like friend family book that it's hard to know where it came from, but like it's been kind of the central mythology of American culture for the past 100 years. So that's been really good.
It sneaks into like so many things that I write, and they're just such archetypal characters that I don't know. It's just, you're so right about that. And I'll also say that stepping on ants is my not saving worms. Like if I don't save a worm, it will like haunt me until I go back and save the worm from the sidewalk. And sometimes when it rains and I'm on a walk and there are so many worms, I have to keep my gaze forward so that I'm like not saving the worms. I'm just like, oh, I'm not noticing these 30 worms on the sidewalk that I can't save.
I know, because you're worm Jesus, you know.
Well, it's funny you say that because it makes me think of the Calvinistic
Jesus Christ
God.
No. Okay, we went in different directions.
We sure did.
Okay.
Because the Calvinistic God, the whole thing is like, well, if your God is like damning people, then isn't he bad? And they're like, no, because the fact that he would even save a single one of us means that he is good. And I think about that. I'm like, well, I can't save all these worms, but I can be the Calvinist God and save some of them and then damn the rest, I suppose, unintentionally.
Well, Chelsea, I just want to tell you that, like, it's part of the human condition to not be able to save all the worms. And I just appreciate everything that you're able to do.
That's really, really kind of you, Sarah, because it does haunt me.
It's
hard. I do
hard.
Wake up screaming. Yeah.
I know. But sometimes at night you still hear it, don't you, Chelsea? You hear the screaming of the worms.
I hear their bodies just scraping across the sidewalk as they're pulling themselves toward a softer life.
Aw, that's a lyric right there.
More after this. You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week, and you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code AmericanHysteria50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And now, back to the show.
What were we talking about?
What the fuck are we talking about? Okay, so back to our hat pin stabbing ladies who are going after the mashers.
Okay, so yes, Susanetta is the woman this town has been looking for.
Exactly, you're right. And in addition to that, we've got like this Chicago law that actually was enacted where they were charging fines. It would be like for a kiss, a non-consensual kiss, it'd be $100. For a wink, $40.
Nice.
Which is like a lot back then. Like,
hard to prove.
I don't know. Is that like $1 million now?
I'm sure.
And then for each additional wink, another $40.
I like to think that someone's like great, great grandma like bought a house that's now worth millions in Chicago because somebody winked at her too many times, and and hearing this, I can hear how this could, you know, like any law, it's gonna be used less against the powerful than against the powerless, but I don't know, it feels validating for the law to even identify this as a problem, to be honest.
Oh I know. And they even went into like catcalling. Like it was in Nebraska. It was at one point, and I don't know for how long, and I don't know how accurate this is. I did my best, but it was $5 for calling a woman chicken, $10 for honey bunch, $15 for turtle dove, $20 for baby doll, and $25 for little cutie.
Wow. Yeah. It feels a little arbitrary, but I believe that they really planned it all out based on some kind of logic.
Some sort of hierarchy there of offense.
Yeah.
So by the 1920s, though, we have the flapper coming into style. We have this, you know, booming party generation after World War One, where women are like hyper empowered, especially teenagers and young adult women. They have money for the first time. They're going out to jazz clubs. We know this story, I think. And mm-hmm. there's just a sudden moral panic.
As there always is when women get jobs.
Yeah, when women get jobs or party, especially if they're partying in jazz clubs with Black people.
Yeah.
So by this time, it's like judges were kind of dismissing charges against these mashers, sometimes on account of this one quote that they were too pretty to be walking alone.
Okay. Shut up.
I know. And so once we get to after World War II is when this new kind of way that men relate to women as watchers comes into play. Mm. And its catalyst is this book by this ad executive named Don J. Sowers. And he writes The Girl Watcher's Guide. Mm. And it's in the style of bird watching books. Okay.
Think of like the number of books that were even like bestsellers in their time that you and I will never hear about. It's staggering.
I know. I do want to shout out Dr. Molly Brookfield, who wrote this great essay that I'm using to help everyone understand what this girl watching craze was. And her essay is called The Girl Watcher, Celebrating a Man's Right to Look in the Postwar USA. So thank you so much to Molly.
Thank you so much, Molly.
Thank you so much, Molly. Academics are our gods.
If not for academics, I would have no idea what was happening and nothing to say to any of you.
We'd be absolutely out of work if we didn't get to pop culturalize your extremely important research. So yeah. Thank you. So, okay, from the 50s to the 70s, kicked off by this 1954 book, there was this craze that swept the entire country, and this archetype of the girl watcher was in newspaper ads, in TV commercials, in books and music and movies, and were used to sell things like liquor and nylons and cigarettes. So this archetype was someone who watched women, but did it so that they didn't notice.
Oh, so, you know, being a peeping Tom.
Yeah. It was basically being a public peeping Tom who was like really good at that skill.
Good Lord.
What we know very well, I think, from our studies, Sarah, about post-war America was that there was a big crisis of masculinity, right? Yeah. Soldiers came back. The women were working and holding down, you know, the entire economy, doing the jobs that the men who were off at war kind of left behind.
Well, and also, you know, immediately post-war America is, again, a big moment for the detective story. And we have, you know, obviously these characters and archetypes existed before, but the kind of noir, hard-boiled detective, he who must walk down those mean streets, who is not mean himself kind of a character, as further proof that it's this time of societal upheaval and gender trouble, we have a big boom in detective stories again.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all, because the girl watching also was almost like a form of being a detective a little bit.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, God, totally. And also mistreating beautiful women is an important part of the detective story of the time. So, yeah.
Of course. And at the same time that we're, you know, having this crisis of masculinity in the country, we're also having, you know, an explosion of suburban life and white collar jobs where dads are carrying briefcases and sitting inside all day and, you know, doing things that at the time felt feminine, like spending time with your fucking wife, you know, and doing all these things in this sculpted American landscape really kind of weighed on the souls of men, you know, who felt sort of like they were losing that core masculinity.
Have you seen the Twilight Zone episode? I think it's called The Stop at Willoughby.
Explain it. Tell me about it.
It's like this businessman who's just like, you know, demeaned at work by his boss. I think like things suck at home too. He keeps falling asleep on the train home and kind of waking up in this sort of ragtime fantasy, early 20th century era where, you know, everyone has time to play and chew the fat and the air is fresh and clean and whatever. And he keeps wanting to get off, but he keeps waking up before he can. And then he finally does get off at Willoughby and he's really happy. And then it cuts to like the workers on the train revealing that he jumped off, and Willoughby is the name of the funeral home that picks up his body, which is also like Rod Serling worked himself to death on the show that, you know, that was an episode of. And that's just the episode. They're like, well, good night. And
they often are like that.
And yeah. It's like sometimes in the Twilight Zone, praying to the gods of capital hollows you out from the inside. Well, good night.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is the, you know, that's the feeling that was going around. And so this idea that you could watch women almost as a spectator sport was coming into popularity because it was this way to kind of indulge in masculinity while still keeping up appearances, not pissing off your wife as much as you would if you were catcalling. But it was also, very importantly, it was considered a pastime of middle and middle upper class white men.
What?
Like, it was a refined, genteel activity.
It's too good for the working man. Let's be honest.
Well, and it was because there was this idea that like that gruffness and that like construction worker archetype, you know, yelling at women and whistling at women was uncouth and they were better than, you know, those who were either working class or black or, you know, any other person of color. You know, they were above them, and their way of looking at women was actually respectful because it was like the women never knew was the whole thing, right?
Mm-hmm. So therefore, you know, it's fine.
Completely fine. So this guy, Donald Sowers, writes The Girls Watching Guide in 1954, and he writes it, it's very tongue-in-cheek, but he writes it in the style of birdwatching books. Okay, so...
Which on the one hand, you're like, oh, that's clever. And on the other hand, you're like, yes, because women are animals.
Yeah, yes, yes. Or they have no more agency than a bird. So here's a quote from that book. Although we believe that girl watching has it all over bird watching, we feel that these two hobbies do share one important feature. They are both genteel. They both respect the rights of the watched. A girl watcher never leers, nor does he utter any sound which might betray his joy.
And in both disciplines, you talk about tits.
Yeah, exactly. And, oh, you got me there. but, you know, and here's a tragedy. I could not find all of the list of different women because part of this guide was like, go out and find these different kinds of women the way you look for different kinds of birds.
Wow.
So some of those were the brown-backed beach bomb.
What?
The pub thrush, which I guess maybe is like a barfly type of lady.
Sure. I mean, the thing is, like, this is, I don't know, it's all perfectly cute. It's just like, I am obviously incapable of taking any of this as, you know, as separate from the most sinister side of all this, which is, you know, we all know.
Yeah, of course, we all know. And so in addition to this book, which kind of sparked this nationwide craze.
Wow.
There were kind of like girl watching influencers, the way that we have kind of like, you know, men's rights influencers, or I guess pickup artist influencers would be the comparison to make there. They would actually teach men, both in these guides and in these different magazines that were girl watcher magazines, how to girl watch successfully. And my favorite was the triangle test. Mm. And this was something that men did to practice eyeball dexterity, to improve how far they could glance and to try to be able to look at two women at the same time.
What?
And the triangle test is like this. You place two photos of two different hot girls 10 feet apart, and then you stand 10 feet back and you try not to move your head at all.
Wow.
Being able to look at both women up and down, right?
It's also like, what if you put that time into reading a book?
Anything else?
I mean, I like that it is something that they are at least putting effort into, you know, like if it's going to be a craze, it shouldn't be an easy craze. They should at least be suffering.
I mean, in this house, we believe that when men try, it is precious.
Yeah, exactly.
I do wish it would be at something different. So they also would put up coat racks and stand back, and they would practice looking the entire thing up and down without moving their head again. So it was like working on their eyes, you know, working on the muscles in their eyes so that they could watch more effectively.
Okay. It's like dressage.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's like EMDR.
I mean, I'm really torn here, Chelsea, because I feel like on the one hand, like, if I'm on a plane or something and like a man is ogling me, do I want it to be something that's obvious to me and that I'm grossed out by? Or do I want it to be something that I don't even notice and it's his little secret? I guess don't want to be stared at the whole time. That's what I want.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal.
We all have a right to look at strangers. And then, you know, once your allotted time is up and it's probably about 6 or 7 seconds, you have to move on with your life.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, again, like this goal was to never let the girl know, which again, you know, I guess it's preferable.
Is both more considerate and more creepy, right?
It is. Yeah. And that's very true. But like an example of another quote from that book is, a guy who asked for a name and phone number was like a bird watcher who stole eggs. Because it was like ruining it for the other girl watchers, right?
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's it. This is also, there's this movie that I have never met a single other person who's seen that was like.
That sounds from, like you. Yeah.
It's from Molly Ringwald's flop era. One thing people must know about me is that I'm a Molly Ringwald stan. And at one time I tried to see almost everything she was in. And so in 1987, she did this movie called The Pickup Artist with Robert Downey Jr., where he's a pickup artist. And it ends up being a beautiful love story between the two of them. But like his pickup artist, you know, naturally he's trying to pick women up. So he's just like running around New York. Like he sees a hot woman, he just like runs over and tries to start a conversation. And that's my image of all this. That's like, it's all, you know, very the opposite and very based on trying to bag a bird. But I guess this really is like bird watching, and that it's like, no, you don't want to eat the duck. You want to notice the duck.
Exactly. Oh, you're getting it now, Sarah. So there was like, in addition to these magazines and these manuals, there were actual girl watching clubs and societies with annual fees. And you get like girl watching like kits and lapel pins and membership cards and novelty items like.
Boy, the more organized you hear about it being, the creepier it gets.
Exactly. And they gave you like novelty items like dark sunglasses so that to aid in your watching. And I would just like to say the only fan club or club where I was mailed any items that I've ever been in was the Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan club.
God, I forgot fan clubs.
I know.
Entirely until this moment. I was in the Mary-Kate and Ashley fan club.
Well, that's cool. I wish I was in that. I wish I was in that now.
I think the Buffy fan club is at least the same. They're both equally cool.
Yeah. Yes. I love Mary-Kate and Ashley and Buffy the Vampire Slayer in mm-hmm. a similar way.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd get like glossy prints mm-hmm. of Angel and Buffy and Cordelia.
Yeah, you would get like posters and there would be like a special fan magazine that only club members could get. God, this is bringing back a lot of stuff for me.
Yeah. So in addition to these clubs, they also had pageants. There was the first international girl watching pageant,
wow.
the Century City Girl Watching Week. And this was something that was like embedded in pop culture. There was a top 10 hit called Girl Watcher by a North Carolina pop group called The Occasions.
Wow. Is it O apostrophe Occasions, I hope?
Yes.
Is it?
It is. It is. It's you got it.
You kind of said it like that. Yeah, you helped me get there. Amazing.
Pepsi really got into this. And one of their ads from around the same time said, "The girls, girl watchers watch. Drink Diet Pepsi Cola with only one calorie. Diet Pepsi. Try it."
The girls, girl watchers watch. Don't do what Donnie Don't does.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this is like not some fringe thing. This
no.
is like worming its way into all kinds of different places.
Everyone is like, women are public property. We have not established culturally that they are people. We probably won't. It's not a question of whether we should stare at them, but, you know, how.
Exactly. And, you know, it was this thing where there were plenty of girls and women who kind of played to this and wanted to be girl watched. So fashion brands started to actually use mannequins as stand-ins for girl watching targets to encourage women to dress for these girl watchers.
Hmm. Because obviously, if it's a big cultural thing there are books about, it's like you're not keeping it secret from women. They're actually hearing about it continually this way.
Yeah. And it is like it was not this thing that caused a lot of anger at the time necessarily. But again, we're talking about the 50s and 60s, kind of pre the next wave of feminism. So at this time, it's just, I don't know, America's very into the patriarchy because, you know, we've had, you know, the nuclear fucking bomb could go off at any time. And we're just mm-hmm. like trying to cling to the American value system that is not kind to most.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's too simplistic, but I do think of the 50s as a period when many people were starting families after having just experienced World War II, you know, many of them as soldiers. And certainly everybody was touched in one way or another. And I think we're kind of in that period now with regards to the pandemic where we kind of can't remember what just happened to us.
Yeah.
And we're like, I am painting my guest bedroom, you know, like that is my concern. I will get to all these horrible feelings later on.
Yeah. And I have got my sedatives.
Yeah, right. Americans have always been great at repression.
Yeah.
It's one of our great gifts.
And the gift of pharmaceuticals has continued to give, hasn't it?
More after this. And now back to the show.
Now we're going to move into 1968, which
nice.
Is the same year that girl watching song came out. So, you
okay.
know, it's still in the lexicon, this idea,
okay.
even though it's 1968, this girl watching thing's been going on since 1954. So it's been around. So it's May of 1968. And that woman wearing the sweater and the skirt, who we mentioned in the beginning, is walking to her job on Wall Street. Okay. She's just minding her own business. She gets off the subway. She starts mm-hmm. walking. And what is, you know, special about this woman are her measurements. All mm. right. And she is this means absolutely nothing to me. I don't know if it means something to you, Sarah, but her measurements were 43, 25, 37.
That does mean something to me.
All I really know is that means she had big gazongas.
Yeah.
She had, yes.
Big gazongas and then a snatched waist and
yeah.
then, hips smaller than her bust, which you just don't see that much.
Okay. All right. You're explaining it well.
And I feel like that is kind of this, like, not, you know, not the masculine ideal, because there is no masculine ideal. Men have infinitely varied tastes, and that's one of the great joys of life for them and everybody
yep.
else.
Men's varied right? tastes. Yep.
You know, not for everyone, but, you know, I guess this idea that, like, I'm so tired of this idea that, like, only a very certain kind of woman is good enough for men, because it's like, listen, men will have sex with spaghetti squash. Like, anyone or anything is good enough for a man in that regard. And in terms of what they're interested in, once they let themselves have personalities, you know, then it yes. can get pretty fun.
Absolutely.
But in terms of those proportions, like, that feels like the kind of body that men are specifically told to be, that is like the highest quality at that point in time, okay. you know, and that's kind of the Playboy body and the go-go body.
Yeah. Cause at this time it was like, we had come off of celebrities like Marilyn Monroe and
mm-hmm. Jane Mansfield.
Jane Mansfield is a great example too. And, you know, the bullet bra was really in, you know, they were really accentuating mm. the breast area through mm-hmm. these new types of bras.
Bra architecture was really taking off, I think. Probably, it probably had something to do with Boeing.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. It usually does. The planes are falling out of the sky. This just reminded me of, like, my absolute abject horror when my mother took me to, of all places, Victoria's Secret to get measured for a bra. You know, my gender, my sexuality, everything at 12 is like under the surface and you don't really fully understand what's going on. But I knew
yeah.
that when I walked into that place, I did not belong there. And I always feel yeah. that way. I'm always terrified when I'm in Victoria's Secret.
It is scary. Yeah. Ugh,
it's a scary place. And then they're looking at you like, can I help you? And I'm like, if you talk to me, I will crumble.
Right. Yeah. I feel like I've always identified as a woman, but the kind of woman who has no idea what to wear to a wedding or like where to get a purse.
Yeah.
You know, nope. just mm-hmm. like, I think because more of a like, yeah, a farmy type and or something. Without a farm, just useless.
You're more of a rose of corn kind of gal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm a rose. Yeah, I belong in the corn.
Nothing wrong with any of you out there who are
no.
Victoria's Secret gals. More power to you.
Oh, yeah.
Keep rocking in the free world. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The world needs all of us. But yeah, I just it's like there's some, like, to me, for example, like, I never learned how to wear makeup and I never tried and I never wanted to. And whenever I have it done for like a wedding or something, it always feels weird. You know, it feels yeah. like there's a face on my face. And it's that just that thing of like femininity as a role where like everyone yeah. plays the role, you know,
it's very like Leatherface
if they play it to different degrees. It is. Yeah. It's like Leatherface when company is coming.
All right. So our dear Francine Gottfried is, again, walking to her job. She's 21 mm-hmm. years old. She's mm. got a job as a clerical worker at Chemical Bank, which is wow. such a 1968 job.
Yes.
So, you know, every day she took the subway to work and then she walked the same route. But by the summertime in August, there was this small group of men that kind of started to notice Francine and her incredible figure, and they started to girl watch her. You know, they mm-hmm. would get together, and this was a little thing they did on their lunch break, because she came in, you know, around their lunch break was when her shift started. Mm-hmm. So at this time, it's like the girl watching was starting to change from this like refined thing where it's like the girls aren't going to notice me, that's the whole goal, to like, and this is my kind of guess at why this changed, was because we have second wave feminism and we have mm-hmm. women out in the public sphere. We have Francine walking to her job on Wall Street, you know, among this these like hordes and hordes of men with their little briefcases. And I think that
yeah.
like kind of the mashers, this was a way to punish women who were, again, asking for, you know, basic civil rights and were, mm-hmm. you know, fighting against what they felt like was mistreatment by men. And that wasn't, you know, they were like, well, we're not going to respect these women anymore. And we're going to just be really overt about the fact that your body is mine in a way.
Right. And if you're working and you've got a figure, you know, right. And this idea that, like, if you wanted to avoid that kind of attention, you would stay home. You know, there's just always a way to blame the victim.
And so, you know, part of this was that she would eventually be called Wall Street's sweater girl. Are you aware of what a sweater girl is?
Oh, my God. I have never been 100% clear on what a sweater girl is. So I'm so happy we're getting down to it, because I know that Lana Turner was a sweater girl.
Yes. Yes. Yep. She was considered the first sweater girl. And this actually came in the 30s. So this was a while before. But all it really was the trend of wearing a tight sweater that accentuates your bosom.
I guess we've always had, you know, stuff like dark academia, like all these historical phases. You're like, what? We had to call that something?
I know.
Especially because, you know, I think by the standards of most people today, a sweater girl is Carrie Russell in Felicity wearing like a giant, you know, Fair Isle pullover.
100%.
And with Lana Turner, too, I mean, she had such a crazy life. And I believe, yeah, I might be getting details wrong, but I'm pretty sure that the probably most dramatic part of her biography is when her daughter murdered her abusive boyfriend.
Yeah, that did happen.
You know, and I feel like there's always this idea with sweater girls of like, yep, they're too beautiful to be treated right. And it's like, are they?
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, there was a whole moral panic about sweater girls, which you can guess. You know, I don't even need to go into that.
These girls are out here wearing sweaters, yes, and men can't control themselves. I mean, do you also, I'm sure you growing up experienced, you know, like the stories about, you know, here's a woman wearing one of the first miniskirts in London caused a man to crash his MG into a pole. And it's like the word caused is doing a lot of work here.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so word got around that these guys were, you know, girl watching our Francine, and more of them started to kind of show up, and it became almost like this little meme at the office where they were like, we're going to go watch Francine and eat our lunch and ogle this poor woman.
God, that's horrifying.
Over the next 3 weeks, that number of men swelled to 2,000. Okay, so there are 2,000 men waiting for this woman to get off the subway so they could just get a look at her.
I hate to say this in mixed company because I know that, you know, people always take this kind of thing the wrong way, but I have to go with my heart. Men are God's first blunder.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really sad. We love you.
And it's a joke, but like, the, you know, there, these are moments when I'm just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, what is happening here? What kind of a fucked up pack mentality? So what is this?
And like, let's also clarify that the type of man that is here watching her are all Wall Street employees. So they're all finance bros, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's like the scariest group of people that you could ever have swell around you. The next day, when Francine showed up, that crowd was 5,000 people.
What?
Yes. What? Yes. The police
there
had to.
There isn't. How? I mean, right. Because like, it's, that's, that feels like there are parades smaller than that. Like, how big is the St. Christopher's Day celebration?
I have no idea the answer to that question, but maybe smaller. But so police had to shut down the street and they had to escort her from this like frothing, panting mob that were like trying to get a look at her. And though I don't know for certain, it does seem like they were grabbing at her as well. And, you know, just kind of swelling around her. It's very, very scary. I mean, they were like climbing on top of cars, like cars got damaged. They were like running upstairs and looking out windows of their offices so that they could see her. And they were just doing everything that you would think of as like a riot is almost approaching, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was a bad vibe there. So, of course, like the crowd was made up mostly of these Wall Street men and made up of people who saw this giant crowd and were like, well, what the hell's going on? You know, I got to go see what that's about. So eventually she had to be actually escorted by the police out of this mob to, be safe. The crowds disperse and then the headlines start the next day, of course, right? So they just loved their puns in these headlines. The best of which is a bust panics Wall Street.
No.
I know. and the bulls and bears turn to wolves also is a good one.
Okay.
But I mean, these guys were like throwing all their ticker tape out their windows as like, you know, people were actually concerned that like the stock market was going to be affected by this because all the finance bros were outside.
I mean, why not? My understanding of the Great Depression was that it was caused by everyone realizing their money wasn't real at the same moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Just having a total existential crisis. So then the next day, after all these headlines have come out, a crowd gathers again, and this time reports say it's anywhere from 10 to 15,000 people, and they're waiting for her. Francine never shows up that day. Shocker.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. And her boss had actually said, like, you can't come in today because you're, like, threatening the economy. But still, poor she Francine. Got like 250 calls, she said, at her house that day. And her boss just was like, you're on an extended vacation. I hope paid. I really hope.
Yeah.
But then they were like, you know, the reporters started to ask Francine, like, what do you think about all of this? And she just said things like, I think they're all crazy. What are they doing this for? I'm just an ordinary girl. There are thousands of girls on Wall Street and they act as though I'm the only one. So she was just like totally taken aback by all of this. And I would like to mention that Don Sowers, our girl watching guide person, was like, he turned his nose up at the scene. Because I would hope so.
I feel like this runs counter to the philosophy of girl watching.
It does. And he said, quote, discreetly, that's the key word.
Yeah.
We use eyeball control. But then he also followed up and said that he wished that he would have got to be there. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. I liked it when he was like, girl watching is an art and you're making a mockery of my discipline.
Oh, my God. So after Francine is, you know, out of the picture, there are all these publicists that are like, I've got an idea. I'll send a girl out there with measurements even more impressive than Francine's.
Oh, my God. God, it's a stressful time to be a big titted woman.
It is. I mean, it always is.
Yeah.
Not that I know. But there was like this office manager named Jerry Stotts, who was flown in by a LA radio station to get publicity for them. And she was wearing what they called a flaming fuchsia mini dress that accented her 47-29-38 figure.
All righty.
Okay, I don't know.
The important thing is that we must constantly describe how women are measured and weighed because, you know, of the livestock category.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. there was also this burlesque dancer named Ronnie Bell who came accompanied by her PR man and announced her measurements to the crowd of 50-22-37.
My God, it's like Chicago.
But both of those women were knocked over and almost trampled in this crowd.
Oh my
and
God.
Like assaulted, and it was really bad. Yeah. And they had to be, you know, swept away in police cars as well. Two men fell off a truck at some point that I feel like, haha.
Were the workers of Wall Street simply so busy that they didn't notice about women until like that week or something?
It seems like, yeah, exactly.
I cannot believe that there was a moment when people were like, this woman with an E cup is walking to work and it might tank the entire economy, not just of the United States, but maybe of the world. And that we don't teach that in high schools. Like that wasn't on the AP exam.
I know.
The reason kids don't like history is because you're teaching the wrong history.
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
Completely agree.
Sorry I shouted.
It's just so absurd because the next day, after these women came by, the next day, the newspaper that was like wired all over the country, of course, there's just like, it's like in every single city. It says, poor little Francine, look at the competition.
What?
And it's like, Francine didn't do this. She didn't do any of this.
Wow.
Poor Francine. But poor Francine did get to dine with the Apollo 10 astronauts.
What?
And she was awarded a dubious achievement award on the cover of Esquire.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah. I mean, not from being around, but from reading Esquire back issues. God, it's like, I will never process this for the rest of my life. Yeah.
No, of course not. Of course not. So, okay. So we don't really know fully what happened to Francine because, of course, we didn't have very detailed records back then, but she was offered a job as a go-go dancer at $100K a year and free housing. And right now, that is the equivalent of $900,000. Okay.
Yeah.
Go-go dancing. And some say she took that job. I don't know for sure if she did. I really hope she did, because just do that job for 1 year, babe, and get out. But yeah, so that is kind of the end of Francine, but not the end of the story, because we've got a prank, Sarah. Ah! We've got a culture jam, little tiny prank. And I know that that, of course, is our favorite thing in the world.
It's our thing.
This kind of avant-garde artist and famous prankster named Joey Skaggs. Do you know him?
No. Who is that?
I think there's going to be a whole episode about him one day, is my desire. So I won't go too far into him.
Part of the American Hysteria extended universe.
Of course. Absolutely. So he was like frustrated by the way that these men were acting. So he decided that he wanted to kind of satirize it. And so he made a like 120 foot long giant bra. What he wanted to do was hang it on the Statue of Liberty, but he wasn't able to do it.
She already has a bra.
I know, right?
She's got Sally Hansen double-sided tape under that tunic.
Oh, so true. So true. So he then tried to stretch it across a Wall Street intersection. That didn't work. You know, the cops stopped him. But eventually he was able to hang it on the outstretched arm of the statue of George Washington in front of the U.S. Treasury building on Wall Street.
Not really iconic.
No.
To be fair. Yeah.
But it was, you know, this giant bra, and it like really made everyone really mad, and they just ripped it down and ripped it to pieces.
Wow.
And I don't really know why they were so mad, because it wasn't like, I don't know.
I mean, I don't like bras either.
Yeah. Rip them down. Rip them down.
Yeah. The one thing we can all agree on, it's he should have taken it. Well, I guess he would have been early, but I just went to Casey, Illinois, where there's the world's largest collection of the world's largest objects, and they should have the world's largest bra. They don't. They do have the world's largest pitchfork and rocking chair, though.
Well, it was ripped to pieces. And actually, Joey Skaggs has tried to get the Guinness Book of World Records to recognize his bra, but they claim that it wasn't as large as he said. And he's like, how do you know? And there's a whole fight.
Those bastards.
But yeah, Joey Skaggs, early ally, creative, wanted that. Speaking of activism, the last thing I want to tell you about is the feminist response to this, you know, Francine Gottfried riot, essentially. So again, it was 1968. So this is like the very beginning of what would become second wave feminism in like a meaningful way. So Francine had talked about in some of her interviews, like, here's a quote. She said, when I was 16, I looked like a woman already. The teachers in Eastern District High School, which I attended, started to look at me, and so did the construction workers in the area. After I saw this happening, I just ignore it, because otherwise I would smile and it could lead them on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who hasn't had that experience?
Yeah.
I mean, God, I remember being 12 and having men just like roll down their windows and it's just it's dark out there.
Yeah, it's really an evergreen kind of sadness to think about how early that rude awakening comes.
Yeah. I don't think people, you know, I just don't think that men fully comprehend that experience of being a child and having that happen.
No.
And I think, you know, a lot of feminists of the time saw themselves in Francine, even though this obviously didn't happen to them, but, you know, understood what it was like to be under the oppression of the male gaze.
Well, it's like Helen of Troy and the idea that beauty can be measured in millihelens, you know.
Right.
So it's like, if you're like, if you have like 200 millihelens, that's how many ships you could launch with your face. So this is like millifrancines, the number of men who could chase you through the streets of the financial district.
Exactly. So there's woman, Carla J, who was like a big time person in this feminist movement, and was formerly an anti-war activist and then kind of channeled her activism toward feminism. She dubbed this situation with Francine, and I can't say for certain she was the first one, but she called it sexual harassment. Mm. And that term was not at all in the lexicon of the world. And I do think it might actually have been the first time that this term was created.
Why isn't Francine on our money?
I know. Put Francine on our money.
Just the New York State quarter. She doesn't have to be on the 20 or anything.
Yeah, it's fine. We're not like shooting for the moon here. We're being reasonable. So, all right. So then, inspired by this panic, Carla J and then this other feminist named Alex Schulman.
Oh, yeah. Alex Kate Schulman.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They, in 1970, so it was a little bit later, but they have said that this was directly in response to the Francine Gottfried incident. Mm. They went to Wall Street and did what they called an ogle in, where they went and sexually harassed all these men on their way to work. So they were like wolf whistling, catcalling. They were, you know, following them around saying, you know, things like, nice legs, don't let yourself go when you get older, honey. And like, wow, look at this cutie coming.
I love it.
And there was even this feminist author Susan Brown Miller, who was part of this, said in her memoir that there was one person there, one of the women, who was a, quote, free-spirited hippie who called herself Wendy Wonderful, and that she sauntered up behind an unwitting passerby and grabbed his crotch, which we do not condone here in American Hysteria.
But it's cathartic to think about it happening in this event.
Yes, yes. So they basically started doing these ogle-ins at different places. It wasn't just this one time. Mm-hmm. And to show kind of what their desire was, this is the sign that they would have at these ogle-ins. It would say, we are giving back some of what we've taken from men on the streets ever since we reached puberty. We're letting men know what it's like to be treated like pieces of meat. We object to being objects. Signed, the Red Witch Collective.
Ah, God.
Just sick as hell. Yeah.
Yeah. Second wave feminism. You know, I think that the journey we've been on reassessing it comes from us sort of beatifying it. Mm-hmm. To an unnecessary, you know, always an unnecessary degree, and then having to assess its shortcomings. And of course, particularly in that so much of it was for middle class white women in the end. But it's also, you know, the fact that that was the message that persisted, or what it got whittled down to, arguably in the 70s, doesn't mean that the second wave feminist movement wasn't, you know, big and capacious and diverse, and that there was especially, I think in the early days, there were so many true radicals who, in the way radicals are, were the first to be beaten down.
Absolutely. And I think it was like a lot more intersectional than we always give credit for, because there are so many issues within the movement. But it's like these people were like anti-war, you know, protesters, and they were, you know, working toward gay liberation often as well. And so it's like, I don't know, we do myself included, I know you included as well, do like to give shit mm-hmm. to second wave feminism.
Yeah, because I want to give shit to my mommy.
Because it's like, where would we be? It's like, that took so, yeah. It just took a lot of guts, man, to do all these things.
I mean, I would not be born, you know, because my mom, I love the... It's a line in Peep Show where Jeremy is like, I'm a very strong feminist, so I think women should do whatever mad thing they feel like, which my mom having a baby out of the clear blue sky at 40 was part of, you know, and wow. She, we know all about each other's parents, you know, nobody's perfect. But like, I grew up with a mom who was like, I was very short round about it. My teachers would be like, now take this to your mom, Mrs. Marshall. And I'd be like, her name is Dr. Joseph. You call her doctor.
Oh, look at you. Born a feminist.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. Born a little liber baby, you know, and I feel like in any movement, there are so many sins to answer for. But I think that, I don't know. And the accounts that have meant the most to me of what women's lib was like in the 60s, there is this very powerful recognition that, you know, feminism is at its most meaningful when it's at the point of intersection with every other move towards civil rights.
Absolutely. Definitely. And I mean, Sarah, that's the end of our story. So that is wow. The Francine Gottfried Wall Street sweater girl.
I had heard of the Ogolin. I didn't know that there were multiples of them. I guess kind of knew of it as a one-time thing somewhere in New York, and I probably mm-hmm. in an American Masters I saw one time. And I love knowing that it, you know, was about this poor woman who, you know, in this circus, which it sounds like it was just awful on so many fronts, that part of the story is also these scary new feminists coming in and, you know, hopefully trying to not just protect her from the horde, but to change the conditions that had allowed one to form to begin with.
Absolutely. And we say, ogle on, girls.
Yeah.
Aww. Ogle on, sisters.
Ogle on, my wayward girls.
Well, thank you so much for letting me tell you the story. I just knew I wanted to share it with you as soon as I saw it. I actually texted you a Wikipedia article, and I think you didn't read it, and that is mm-hmm. for the better today. So,
yeah, I definitely didn't. Look, only on days when my Sims health level is green can I read links.
That is completely fair. I need to not send you anything ever, actually, because I always just want to tell you about it on this show or while we snuggle up like we're going to do this weekend when we go to the Washington State Fair.
I know. You're going to take me to the fair. I'm so excited. I want to close. This feels related to the fair just by sharing something that has meant weirdly a lot to me with you, which is I was at a bookstore. I'm going to get the name wrong. It's called something like the Tin Mailman or something. It's in Northern California. And I got this book called Corn's a Poppin', Popcorn Recipes and Party Ideas for All Occasions. And I bought it as like, this is the weirdest cookbook I've seen in a while. And I like to buy weird cookbooks when I see them. And then let me read you just the opening of chapter 2.
Okay.
How you can grow popcorn for pleasure and profit. The paragraph goes, if you have a few spare feet of fertile soil in a sunny backyard, you may want to try growing your own popcorn patch. A tiny plot, 4 foot by 8, should yield about 5 quarts of kernels. Since popcorn increases approximately 32 times in volume from kernel to morsel, you'll get 160 quarts of popped corn, which is almost enough for every single recipe, decoration, and Faber described in this book. If you can double the size of your plot to 8 by 8 feet, you'll have enough for your own needs, plus extra corn to sell to neighbors and friends. So I read this and thought it was just kind of the most whimsically crazy thing I'd ever heard. And then I guess it lodged in my brain because I spent this morning planting a popcorn patch.
Oh, okay. And you know what this is going to serve for us is making a corn maze one day.
Yeah. Oh, we can make a corn maze.
We'll harvest the popcorn and then we'll have that friggin' haunted corn maze of our dreams. And it's going to be really scary. None of this mamby-pamby shit. Yeah.
Yes. But I guess it feels in a way almost like finding a book of esoterica to like find this weird out of print book written by some maniac about popcorn and then, you know, for your life to change because of it. Or maybe my corn won't grow and everything will be the same. But I don't know. I feel like that's very in the Chelsea Weber Smith way of life, where it's like every time I do one of these episodes with you, like I feel like the world is richer and deeper and weirder than I gave it credit for. And I don't know, when life feels just kind of bleak and miserable, I do find it really encouraging that like there are always more facts that it's going to give you pleasure to learn.
I could not agree with you more. And I feel that way about you as well. Every time we get together, it's like a deep dive into a world I could never imagine and one that I wish that I had had the whole time. So we're going to be doing a lot of that this weekend.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited.
I can't wait.
And let's just say I hope that anyone digging up the Girl Watcher's Guide obscure print book does something with it, like maybe some kind of art project where they take it back.
Ah, yes. And I can't wait to see the fruits of that.
Take it back, gals.
Mm.
Ogle on.
Ogle on.
This was American Hysteria. Make sure you listen to You're Wrong About and You Are Good wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to get more of our show, you can go to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You'll get ad-free episodes as well as bonus content, including access to my other podcast, Hysteria Home Companion, that I do with our producer, Miranda, where we tell you stories that were either cut from the episode or stories we think that you'd really like. Most recently, I told Miranda about an elaborate 19th century April Fool's Day hoax in London that involved hundreds of people, from bakers and undertakers to bankers and politicians. So just go to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. It's also a really great way to support our show. Another really great way to support our show is by leaving us a 5-star review on the app of your choosing. It only takes a second, and you could actually do it right now if your phone is in your hand. And if your phone is in your hand, you could also follow us on Instagram at American Hysteria Podcast. If you go to AmericanHysteria.com, you can leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline about a tale that you remember from growing up, and we might just do an entire episode about it. AmericanHysteria.com is also where you can get your mitts on some of our merch. Our producer and editor is Miranda Zickler, and our associate producer is Riley Swedelius Smith. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I hope you have a great week.